Hey there, it's Kathy. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to History of the 90s early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. When Raw is War began on May 24th, 1999, the millions of viewers who tuned in to the weekly wrestling show weren't greeted with the usual display of pyrotechnics and over-the-top excitement. That's because 24 hours earlier, one of the WWE's most beloved performers had plummeted to his death during a live pay-per-view event. And then, in a shocking and highly criticized decision, the rest of the show continued. So the wrestling world took time the next night to remember and honor the man they lost in the stunning incident.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler here at ringside. We thank you very much for being with us and what we truly believe will be one of the most unique broadcasts ever in the genre of sports entertainment here tonight.
Missing from that broadcast was the wrestler's widow, who was at home with their two small children trying to process what had happened. And more importantly, why? A question that would cause a rift in Canada's most famous wrestling family. I'm Kathy Kanzora, and this is History of the 90s, a podcast about a decade that changed the world. In this episode, we look back at the life and tragic death of Owen Hart. The Hart family dynasty began with Owen's father, a longtime wrestler, booker, and promoter. Stu Hart grew up in the Alberta prairies, in the midst of the Great Depression. His family somehow survived brutal winters in a tent, mostly living off the land. As a teenager, Stu moved to Edmonton, where he took up wrestling at the YMCA. After stints playing pro football and serving in the Navy during World War II, Stu went to New York City to wrestle professionally. Kevin Mickey, an associate producer and reporter at Sportsnet, says by the late 1940s, Stu and his new wife Helen moved back to Calgary, Alberta, where they launched a pro wrestling promotion that would eventually become Stampede Wrestling.
He was the booker, he was the promoter, he was head of everything to do with the money. You call him the CFO, CEO, COO. That was Stu Hart in a nutshell, with his wife supplying everything that she possibly could on the side. Helen Hart was integral to the entire operation. Stu, Helen together running this territory and also teaching people how to wrestle at the same time.
Today, Stampede Wrestling is remembered for featuring some of the biggest names in the sport, including Gorgeous George, Killer Kowalski, and Andre the Giant. In addition to running the show, Stu Hart achieved a level of notoriety for personally training burgeoning talent in the basement of his Calgary mansion, which was nicknamed The Dungeon. Kevin Mickey says Stu tested potential wrestlers in the dungeon to make sure they had what it would take to be successful in the ring.
And by testing, he would do what they would call stretching someone. So he would put them in various holds, submission holds, until they're ready to pass out, until they're turning purple. And he would say, do you want to come back the next day? And if you said, yes, sir, I do want to come back, then Stu would slowly, slowly let you in on how the business works.
While building their wrestling business, Stu and Helen were also busy building their enormous family. 12 kids, 8 boys and 4 girls. All of the boys either became wrestlers or worked in the industry, and each of the girls married a wrestler employed by their father. In 1984, a new era began for the Harts when the WWE purchased Stampede Wrestling. And I should note that at the time, the WWE was still called the WWF. But to keep things simple, I will refer to it as the WWE throughout this episode. The sale of Stu Hart's wrestling promotion meant that American audiences now had a chance to get to know Stampede wrestlers, including one of Stu's sons. With his smooth style and technical proficiency, Bret the Hitman Hart quickly emerged as a fan favorite as part of the Hart Foundation, eventually becoming a 5-time heavyweight champion. Meantime, the youngest Hart sibling was making his own way in wrestling, finding early success in Japan and Europe. At 5'11" and 230 pounds, the blonde-haired Owen Hart was considered by many to be the most naturally gifted wrestler in the family. So it was no surprise when he was signed by the WWE in 1988 at the age of 23. Instead of playing on Owen's connection to his famous older brother, WWE boss Vince McMahon decided to keep the younger Hart's identity a secret. Owen was put under a mask as the caped superhero, the Blue Blazer. Kevin Mickey says as the Blue Blazer, Owen Hart quickly made an impression by showing off his acrobatic talents.
Owen Hart was the type of wrestler that was your favorite wrestler's wrestler a lot of the time. Incredible in ring work, bringing a style that melted together a blend of old school, thanks to the training that his father Stu Hart and the Hart family dungeon in Calgary gave to him, and new school, thanks to Hart's high-flying, fast-paced work inside of the squared circle. He just had that perfect meld together that made you want to watch, that made you want to keep coming back to watch this young high flyer. He was just superb in everything that he did.
Despite his impressive work in the ring, the WWE did little with Owen and his Blue Blazer character, relegating him to being little more than a jobber, the nameless guys who get squashed by the stars every night. This eventually prompted Owen to leave the company for a couple of years to work internationally. And during that time, he explored getting out of wrestling altogether, and even unsuccessfully applied to be a Calgary firefighter. But the WWE came calling again, and this time, Owen was promised his talent would not be wasted. When Owen Hart rejoined the WWE in 1991, the Blue Blazer character was ditched, because this time he would wrestle under his real name. Initially, Owen was introduced to fans as the tag team partner of his brother-in-law, Jim the Anvil Neidhart. Then, when Neidhart left the WWE, he became the tag team partner of Coco Beware. Sure, it was great that Owen was able to wrestle as himself, but he was still being relegated to tag team action. Then, with a little help from his family, the Rocket finally got the high-profile break he was waiting for. In November 1993, Owen teamed up with his superstar brother Brett, as well as two other Hart brothers, Bruce and Keith, at an undercard match at the Survivor Series pay-per-view event. They were supposed to be up against Brett's arch-rival, Jerry the King Lawler, and his three knights. But Lawler was pulled from the lineup because he was facing charges of sexually assaulting a 13-year-old girl. Those charges were eventually dismissed, and Lawler pleaded guilty to harassing a witness. So at the Boston Garden Family Feud match, the Harts competed against Shawn Michaels and a group of masked men. Kevin Mickey says during the match, Owen inadvertently crashed into Brett, sending his brother off the apron and onto the floor below.
And as everyone was tending to Brett, Owen was rolled up for the 1-2-3, and he was eliminated. He was furious that the entire family attended to Brett while they left Owen essentially to fend for himself, or forgot about Owen.
In the end, the Harts won, but following the Survivor Series, Owen shared his frustrations during a sit-down interview with Vince McMahon.
I've been living in the shadow of you, Brett, all my life, and I'm sick and tired of it. So, Brett, there's only one way to solve this thing, with me being the shadow of you, the Hitman. That's right. Why don't you go out and step up to the plate? You and me, face to face, one-on-one. I'm challenging you, Brett, my brother, to a fight, one-on-one.
This was the beginning of a storyline that would transform Owen's career. It continued at the Royal Rumble in January 1994, when Brett and Owen were teamed up against the Quebecers. Brett injured his leg during the Tag Team Championship match, which ended up being called by the ref. Owen was furious that his brother didn't tag him in to save the match. The youngest Hart sibling was fed up with his selfish older brother hogging the spotlight. So Owen attacked Brett, kicking his injured leg, and in the process, completed a dramatic heel turn. For the next couple of months, Owen repeatedly challenged his brother to a match, which Brett refused. It was a family feud never seen before in the WWE. And the pair really committed to the illusion of their animosity, making sure they were never spotted together while traveling or dining out. Even at large family gatherings, if outsiders were present, the two would keep their distance. Finally, in March 1994, Bret Hart agreed to face Owen at WrestleMania 10. Their dad, Stu, joined hundreds of others at a Calgary bar and casino to watch his two sons compete at the event. Millions more around the world tuned into the pay-per-view event broadcast live from Madison Square Garden in New York. The first match pitted Owen and Bret Hart against each other. The pair put on a wrestling masterpiece that was technically spectacular, exciting, and unpredictable because no one expected that Owen would win. But he did, pinning his brother after 20 minutes of action. It's remembered as one of the biggest upsets in WWE history. And for Kevin Mickey, it's his favorite WrestleMania moment of all time.
WrestleMania 40 is the latest WrestleMania, so there have been 40 of these things. WrestleMania 10, 30 years ago, this match, Bret Hart versus Owen Hart, brother versus brother, still stands up. It is an incredible, incredible piece of athleticism, piece of entertainment. The art form is at its highest peak.
And no doubt it was a high point for Owen's career. Although he was overshadowed by Bret once again when the older brother won the title match later that night. Bret the Hitman, weighing in at 230 pounds, pinned the 500-pound Yokozuna to become WWE champion. In the crowded ring following the victory, only brother Owen refused to congratulate Bret. He walked by, shook his head at his brother, shouted a comment, and walked away, setting the stage for another brother versus brother family feud. And fans didn't have to wait too long. The next Hart showdown came just 5 months later at SummerSlam in Chicago, when the Hitman defended the WWE title against his younger brother in an epic steel cage match. The steel cage is iconic and a fan favorite, and adds an extra layer of danger, excitement, and violence. Basically, the easiest way to win a cage match in wrestling is to escape the cage, either by climbing over the top of the cage wall and reaching the arena floor with both feet hitting the mat, or by climbing through the cage door and contacting the floor. For the Hart brothers, it must have felt like their younger years in the dungeon. Either way, they pulled off a cage match that was a technical showcase and a narrative masterpiece, while capturing the essence of their red-hot rivalry. In the end, Bret escaped the cage, beating Owen and keeping his WWE title. Even though he lost, the exciting match elevated Owen's status in the eyes of fans, cementing him as a top-tier talent within the industry. It was an exciting time for Owen Hart. He had finally found his place as the WWE's top villain. In 1994, he also won the King of the Ring tournament, turning back Razor Ramon in the finals with an elbow drop to the back and with an assist from Jim Neidhart. It was after that victory that Owen dropped the Rocket nickname and took the title of the King of Hearts. Then in April 1995, at WrestleMania 11, Owen teamed up with Yokozuna and won the WWE Tag Team Championship by defeating the Smokin' Guns, Billy Gunn and Bart Gunn. Jim Cornette, Yokozuna's manager, began calling the duo Camp Cornette. And with that, the villainous faction was born, and eventually they added a couple of other wrestlers to their stable. Owen definitely excelled at being a heel, but Kevin Mickey says, out of the ring, he was beloved by his fellow wrestlers.
Even though he was apparently the king of ribs, as they say, he was the king of pranks in the back, he would constantly be pranking everybody, and everyone would just go, God damn it, Owen got me again.
Owen was also teased for being a cheapskate. For example, he sometimes befriended fans to catch rides places while on the road, instead of paying for a rental car. But most of all, Owen was admired by his colleagues because of his devotion to his wife, Martha, and their two kids. Owen and Martha began dating when they were in high school in Calgary. They married in July 1989 in an elaborate wedding at the Hart family mansion. Their son, Oj, was born 2 years later, and their daughter, Athena, 3 years after that. But Martha, who holds a doctorate in social and developmental psychology, wasn't happy. In her book, Broken Hearts, The Life and Death of Owen Hart, Martha makes it very clear that she didn't like wrestling and desperately wanted her husband to find another career path. But he was a Hart. Wrestling was in his blood, and the allure of the ring proved to be too strong and pulled Owen back multiple times. The feud between the Hart brothers didn't last forever. In 1997, Bret the Hitman Hart turned heel in dramatic fashion after losing a steel cage match on Monday Night Raw thanks to interference by The Undertaker. Following the match, when Vince McMahon went into the ring to interview Bret about the loss, a frustrated Hitman violently shoved McMahon to the mat, then launched into a profanity-laced tirade on the live broadcast.
You screwed me, everybody screws me, and nobody does a goddamn thing about it. Nobody in the building cares, nobody in the dressing room cares. So much goddamn injustice around here, I've had it up to here.
The incident led to the USA Network putting a 7-second delay on WWE broadcasts. And more importantly, it kicked off Bret's heel turn, which many believe marked the beginning of the Attitude Era. The turn also ended the 3.5-year feud between the Hart brothers. After Bret became a heel, he interrupted a match between Owen and their brother-in-law, the British Bulldog, and delivered a speech about how America had turned the Hart family against each other. Owen sobbed as his brother spoke about family values. Then the trio hugged in the middle of the ring. Fans were witnessing the birth of the Hart Foundation 2.0. Joined by Brian Pillman and Jim the Anvil Neidhart, for the next several months, the Hart Foundation played up a pro-Canada angle and became the most hated act on any US WWE show. The Canada-USA angle slowly dissipated, though, as behind-the-scenes issues between Bret Hart and Vince McMahon were building, eventually leading to a night remembered as the Montreal Screwjob. In the fall of 1997, Bret Hart signed a deal with WWE competitor the WCW, owned by Ted Turner, because Vince McMahon said he could no longer afford to fulfill the Hitman's contract. Bret was the champ at the time, and wrestling tradition states that a wrestler going to another organization gives up his title before leaving by losing his final match. Hart didn't want to do that, though. He wanted to go out as a champ and hand over the belt on his own terms. And he definitely didn't want to lose to his longtime arch-rival Shawn Michaels in front of a Canadian crowd. After a tense week of negotiations, Bret entered the ring in Montreal, having come to an agreement with McMahon. The match with Michaels would end with an indecisive disqualification. And on the next night's episode of Monday Night Raw, Hart would make a speech and relinquish the title. Little did he know, McMahon and Michaels had conspired against him. Late in the match, when Shawn Michaels put Bret in a submission hold, Vince McMahon ran down to the ring and ordered the referee to ring the bell. The match ended and a shocked-looking Michaels retrieved the championship belt. Bret went ballistic, spitting in McMahon's eye, destroying AV equipment, and pacing furiously around the ring, signing WCW with his hands to the audience. Bret maintains to this day he had no idea the match was going to play out that way. A casualty of Bret's dramatic departure was his younger brother, Owen. The WWE struggled to find him a storyline, initially refashioning him as a sympathetic hero seeking vengeance for Bret. But management only gave the storyline a half-hearted push, and it fizzled out after a few months. Owen eventually returned to being a villain, but he resisted efforts by the WWE to put him in edgy, risque storylines, which were becoming increasingly common in the New Attitude Era. For example, Owen outright refused an angle that would have seen him pursue an affair with Deborah McMichael, the former wrestling valet who managed Owen and his tag team partner, Jeff Jarrett, who was also Deborah's on-screen boyfriend. The King of Hearts didn't want to put his wife and kids through the embarrassment of a fake love triangle, and according to Martha's memoir, he didn't consider it for even a minute. Not long after he refused the storyline, the WWE told Owen they wanted him to return to his long-ago masked persona, the Blue Blazer. Bret Hart has said in interviews that he believes it was Vince McMahon's way of punishing his younger brother for not being a team player. Either way, Owen was back behind a mask in his superhero costume. But this time, he played the Blue Blazer as a winkingly obvious alter ego of himself, whose earnest do-goodery stretched to parody. He managed to turn what could have been a cringeworthy revival of an outdated gimmick into an endearing and entertaining performance. As the Blue Blazer, Owen mocked rival WCW stars like Hulk Hogan and Sting, who regularly rappelled from the rafters to the ring below. In late 1998, Owen as the Blue Blazer imitated Sting by clumsily descending into the ring at a match using a locking carabiner, which made it hard for him to get out of the harness. Then, 6 months later, Owen was told to do the stunt again. On May 23, 1999, Owen Hart, dressed as Blue Blazer, was set to wrestle The Godfather for the WWE International Championship in the second part of an event called Over the Edge, which was being broadcast live on pay-per-view television. The lights were dimmed at Kemper Arena in Kansas City, Missouri, as a video of a pre-recorded interview with Owen played for the sold-out audience in the arena, as well as fans watching at home. Up in the rafters, 8 stories above the arena floor, Owen was standing on a catwalk, waiting to make his entrance.
People are saying now that Owen was a little hesitant about doing the stunt, and he wasn't necessarily super confident with it, but being the guy that he is, he said, okay, I'm going to go through with it, no problem.
As Owen hung precariously above the ring, suddenly he plummeted 78 feet to the ring below, striking the ropes and landing on his back on the mat.
Jimmy Corderas told me a story once. He was the referee in the ring at the time, and he was standing there ready for the bout. And as Owen was falling, he said that he could hear someone yelling, and it was Owen as he was falling. And Jimmy says that he thought he heard Owen telling him to get out of the way. So Owen's last moments were trying to protect someone else.
Audience members were stunned and confused about what they had just witnessed. Some thought it was a doll at first, perhaps some kind of sick joke. The arena was in complete silence for about 30 seconds. Then a low murmur began to spread as people asked, "Is it real? Who was that?" Because of course, Owen had been wearing the Blue Blazer mask, so it was hard for people to identify the person lying in the ring. When the pre-taped interview of Owen ended, the camera returned to play-by-play announcer Jim Ross, who told viewers that something had gone terribly wrong with Owen's planned entrance. And he assured them, this is as real can be. The cameras panned to a mostly still crowd, as Ross described the EMTs who were working on Owen in the ring. At one point, a grave-looking Jerry Lawler joined Ross on camera after helping attend to Owen. With a faraway stare, Lawler said, "It doesn't look good at all." Owen was eventually removed from the ring on a gurney, and to the amazement of everyone, the show continued. Meantime, the King of Hearts was rushed to a nearby hospital where he was pronounced dead. Owen Hart was 34 years old. About an hour later, as Over the Edge continued, Jim Ross provided viewers with an update.
I have the unfortunate responsibility to let everyone know that Owen Hart has died. Owen Hart has tragically died from that accident here tonight.
And even still, the show continued. Vince McMahon was denounced in the media for not stopping the broadcast. Bret Hart told the New York Times that continuing the show after his brother's fall was very cold-blooded. His wife, Martha, told CBS Sports that McMahon's actions were beyond disrespectful. She said when Owen died, they scooped him out like a piece of garbage, and they paraded wrestlers out to wrestle in a ring that had Owen's blood, where the boards were broken from Owen's fall and where the guys could feel the dip in the ring from where he fell. The night after Owen's death, the WWE attempted to honor the King of Hearts in a way that was more fitting. When Raw's war began in St. Louis, nearly the entire WWE roster silently stood on the entrance ramp for a 10-bell salute. Tears streamed down the faces of many wrestlers, fans, and even the referees as a video honoring Owen appeared on a huge screen. Many of the wrestlers wore black armbands with the initials OH on them, and the crowd chanted his name. In between 10 matches that night, Owen's colleagues shared what the talented wrestler had meant to each of them on a show that was renamed Raw is Owen. In his tribute, Mick Foley called Owen the nicest, funniest person he had ever met. While Triple H, who had served as Owen's primary on-screen antagonist for the previous 18 months, was red-faced and breathing heavily as he choked out, "You'll always be my friend and I love you." It was an honest and candid reaction from a sport normally cloaked in fantasy. Earlier that day, homicide detectives were called to Kemper Arena in Kansas City to inspect the rigging that was supposed to lower Owen by cable from the arena catwalk. They also interviewed stagehands to determine what went wrong. They quickly concluded that the cable didn't break and suggested that Owen may have accidentally tripped a lever early. This infuriated the entire Hart family, who said Owen was too smart for that kind of mistake. They pointed the finger at Vince McMahon, saying as the promoter of the event, he should be held responsible for the terrible tragedy. 8 days after his death, a funeral fit for a king was held in the Hart's hometown. Fans gathered in drizzling rain outside the Calgary Chapel to listen to the emotional service, which was broadcast on loudspeakers. Among the hundreds of mourners that filled the pews were the Alberta Premier and Calgary Mayor, along with dozens of star wrestlers, rivals united in grief from the WWE and the WCW. During his remarks, Hulk Hogan, who at the time was known as Hollywood Hogan, had high praise for Owen, telling the mourners that in a business full of drugs and wife cheaters, he did none of that, and everybody respected him. Hogan said, "I wish I was more like him." Vince McMahon and his family also attended, but came and left through a side door, away from the glare of the media. Before he left, Martha Hart vowed there would be justice for her husband. In her tribute to Owen, she said, "There will be a final day of reckoning. I won't let him down." On June 15, 1999, with Owen's parents and brother Brett at her side, Martha Hart announced at a news conference in Kansas City that they had just filed a 118-page wrongful death lawsuit. It listed 46 counts of negligence against Vince McMahon and 12 others, including the WWE's parent company, Titan Sports, and the riggers who set up the stunt. The lawsuit claimed that the previous time Owen had been lowered into the ring, the WWE had used Joe Branham. The experienced rigger had worked with everybody from Elton John to the Rolling Stones. He did it the right way, but on camera, it looked clunky as Owen struggled to get disconnected from the harness. Leading up to the day of Owen's death, the WWE turned to Bobby Talbert, who had little experience with this style of stunt, and he used a harness equipped with a quick-release clip, also known as a snap shackle, which is normally used for sailing. Owen was unaware that it took only 6 pounds of pressure to trigger the clip's release. All he had to do was adjust his cape or take one breath, and the expansion of his chest would trigger its release. The lawsuit asked that a jury determine damages that were fair and reasonable, but the media speculated at the time that Martha could be awarded upwards of $500 million. Over the coming months, things would get very ugly, and not just between Martha and the McMahons. Several members of the Hart family and extended family were also angry that Owen's widow was pursuing the case. You see, several of them, including Davey Boy and Jim Neidhart, were still actively involved with the WWE, and they were worried the legal case would tank their careers. Family infighting boiled over as some of the Hart kids put pressure on the parents to settle out of court. And Martha even accused the Hart sisters of sharing confidential documents with lawyers working for the WWE. Meantime, the criminal investigation into the case had concluded, with no charges being laid. The prosecutor said he could build a case for gross negligence, but felt the chances of a successful prosecution were not high enough to proceed. In the fall of 1999, the WWE launched a countersuit against Martha, stating that she had breached Owen's contract, which stated any legal action taken against the WWE must be litigated in its home state of Connecticut, where punitive damages aren't awarded. As it seemed that things were only going to keep getting messier, there was a surprise announcement. In November 2000, the lawsuit was settled out of court. It was reportedly worth $18 million, with $10 million allocated to Martha $3 million to each of Owen's children, Oge and Athena, and $1 million to each of his parents, Stu and Helen. Martha was frustrated, though, because for her, it wasn't about the money. She wanted the matter to go to trial, so the public could hear about all of the mistakes made by the WWE. She believed that's how she could get justice for Owen. But Martha says she agreed to the settlement because some members of the Hart family were working against her and she feared she might lose it all. Following the settlement, Martha used $2 million to start the Owen Hart Foundation, which continues to operate today. And among other things, offers scholarships to Calgary students and a home ownership program for low-income families. In 2021, the Owen Hart Foundation also began a partnership with All Elite Wrestling to host the annual Owen Hart Cup. Winners receive a trophy called the Owen. Today, Martha says she has forgiven the WWE, but says she will never allow Owen to be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame because it's just another way for them to make money off her husband. This position has upset Bret Hart, who has been pretty vocal about it. He has accused Martha of erasing his brother's legacy. But Kevin Mickey doesn't think that's possible.
I don't necessarily need Owen Hart to be celebrated in the WWE Hall of Fame to remember the kind of wrestler and human that he was. If you're a pro wrestling fan, if you want to investigate the history of pro wrestling, if you want to know who some of the greatest pro wrestlers of all time were, you're going to go back and find out about Owen Hart.
Kevin says, however, it would be nice if Owen Hart was honored with a star alongside his brother Bret on Canada's Walk of Fame in downtown Toronto. And I have to say, I couldn't agree more. Thanks for listening to this look back at the life and death of Owen Hart, a man remembered by many names. The Rocket, the King of Hearts, the Slammy Award-winning Owen Hart, Nugget, the Blue Blazer, the Nug, the Black Heart, the Soul Survivor, Oge, and most importantly, Dad. Thanks also to Kevin Mickey for sharing his wrestling knowledge once again. I think he's my first repeat guest on History of the 90s. Kevin joined us back in February 2020 on an episode about the WWE's Attitude Era. If you haven't heard it, make sure you go back and check it out. It was a ton of fun. This topic was suggested quite a long time ago by listener Miles Peary, so special thanks also to Miles. If you have an idea for a show, please let me know. Just send me a message on Instagram at That90sPodcast or send an email to 90s@curiouscast.ca. This episode was hosted and written by me, Kathy Kinzora. Our producer is Dila Velasquez, and sound design and final production is by Rob Johnston. See you next time for more History of the 90s.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.